Evolution can be defined as changes in allele frequencies as a function of time. Though we can spend a lot of time considering changes in allele frequencies, in this lecture what we're going to consider instead is time. Basically, the technical means by which one can passage organisms through time and so that they in fact can evolve in some manner, and also various theory that's associated with that passage and also consequences that can result from this passage. This is the underlying basis of what experimental microbial population biology or experimental microbial evolution is all about. So right now, first, we're going to be studying in this chapter passage through time, or passage of microorganisms through time. So now we're switching gears to serial passage experiments. And specifically, this is experiments where we're passaging various kinds of organisms, mostly pathogens, through animals or some other kind of multicellular organism. There's also a few examples of passage within broth cultures or chemostat passage or what have you. But a lot of the emphasis will be basically on passaging pathogens that are animal pathogens, either through animals or through tissue culture instead. So this is just an illustration of a vaccination that's going on. So vaccines, these are pathogens that are less virulent against humans, but they retain their antigenicity, and as a consequence, they stimulate adaptive immunity, and the result is that people develop potentially long-term immunity against pathogens that they've never actually experienced infections of, or at least full-blown infections of it, cause substantial disease. Presumably, these pathogens that have been attenuated, as they say, so that they are less virulent, less able to cause disease, presumably we could take these pathogens and if we wanted to, we could actually select for, instead of attenuation, instead an increase in the virulence of those pathogens. And how would we go about doing that? Well, it turns out that the way one would go about selecting for increased virulence in a pathogen is equivalent to the way that one goes about selecting for decreases in virulence, that is attenuation of a pathogen. And specifically, this is done via serial passage. So serial passage. So serial passage has the effect of causing organisms to grow more effectively in their new environment, for example, while infecting a new host. So if you take a pathogen, it's evolved, it is adapted to growing on one particular host, and then you switch it to a somewhat different host. Initially, that pathogen is not going to be very effective in that new host, but if you passage it within that new host repeatedly, often these pathogens will increase in their potential to infect these new hosts, and in fact can display substantial increases in virulence over time. So you can end up with the more effective exploitation by an organism of a new environment or of a new host organism. That is an increase in the virulence associated with these organisms. Following serial passage, organisms can also persist within hosts for longer, so the immune system can have more trouble getting on top of these infections. And so you can have more effective growth within these within host organisms by pathogens. You can have an increased amount of disease that's caused, and you can have a resistance to clearance or an increased resistance to clearance from these hosts. These things, to a large extent, go hand in hand. If you're going to have more growth, you're going to have more organisms. If the growth is going to persist for longer, you're going to have more organisms. The result is that you can end up with greater amounts of disease. If a selection scheme requires that there be between host transmission, then potentially you will also evolve more effective transmission between hosts. Alternatively, if one bypasses the normal means by which transmission is effected during these experiments, then you have the potential to actually lose an ability to transmit between hosts. So the pathogen, the organism that you're serially transferring, is going to become better and better and better at whatever it is that you're caught that you're requiring it to do. Those things that you don't require it to do, it may very well get worse at. So these are all things that are occurring on the new host. On the old host, by contrast, the pathogen will tend to become less effective. And so if this was instead of a host, if it was an old environment, it'd be less effective at growing or surviving in its old environment. It can become less effective at exploiting that environment or that old host. Therefore, we describe it as being attenuated or displaying greater attenuation, as well as less virulence in this new host. It may be less effective in evading the new host's immune system, therefore more effectively cleared from the new host. It also may be less effective at initiating infections on the new host. All of these things are basically represent specialization. The growth on this old host, the pathogen presumably was specialized for that growth, and when it got transferred to the new host and was serially passaged on this new host repeatedly, it evolved mutations. It fixed mutations that allowed it to grow more effectively on this new host. But some of these mutations may have caused it to grow less effectively on its own host. So therefore, it switched its specialization from growing on this host to growing on this host. Alternatively, if you had a pathogen that was growing on both of these hosts, and then you switched it to just growing on one of those hosts, it might go from displaying a more generalist infection strategy to ones that are more specialized, so that they would become more effective on growing on whatever host they're being passaged on, versus between the ability to grow somewhat well on both of the hosts. So specialization is what you're seeing here. It's also useful to do these serial passage experiments, not just to reduce the virulence on one host, increase it on another, but to simply evolve new properties in organisms, such as a new ability to use or an improvement in its ability to use a specific carbon source. But with regard to attenuated vaccines, if we've got a pathogen that's growing on us, that uses us for a host, often we're able to take that pathogen and passage it through a new host, and in the process, that pathogen become more effective at replicating and exploiting this new host, but at the same time, often they'll become less effective at growing and exploiting ourselves. And so the basis of attenuated vaccine development often is just switching the host and doing repeated serial passages so that you evolve an increased attenuation on one host, though it comes at the it comes along with a decrease attenuation and increased display of virulence on the new host. But we don't really care about the new host, right? So long as we are able to use the attenuated vaccines on ourselves as a relatively benign means of reducing our susceptibility to infections. This table basically reiterates what I've just said. In fact, what I just said basically comes from this table or tables like it. Actually, it's interesting, the table, because it's got at least, I think, two mistakes in it, but I'll try to go through it without making too big of a deal of the mistakes, but the editor in me is probably going to prevent me from doing that. So the table, summary of observed evolutionary changes relative to the ancestral parasite. So you've got the parasite that you began with, and then you have the evolved form of the parasite during serial passage experiments with large transfer sizes. So large transfer sizes are key because that means that we have a large fraction of the parasites being transferred with each step. So even relatively minor alleles within the parasite population will be transferred as well. So they'll have the potential to increase in fitness, increase in frequency in the course of the serial passage experiment. If you did the serial passage experiment instead with substantial bottlenecking, such as reducing the parasite to the parasite population to a single individual per transfer, then the result can be a instead genetic drift, or alt if the parasite doesn't display much mutation, then instead potentially retention of the ancestral parasite form. But when you're transferring large numbers, then that's the perfect way that you can enhance the likelihood that natural selection is going to take place. And so what we're seeing here is what happens when we evolve a parasite on a new host. And so it's looking at the evolution, the properties on this new host relative to the former host. Now, when I was reading through this, I realized that there's a comma or something missing, because if you read through it doesn't actually make all that much sense. But this is what's going on. We're simply taking a parasite population that was adapted to a former host. We are now transferring it to a new host, and we're passing it repeatedly on that new host with large transfer sizes, so as to enhance the efficiency of natural selection. So what is the result? So the result is that on the new host, so this is the passaged host, the new host, we get an increase in virulence. So that's an increase in the level of disease affected by the parasite. We have the parasite growing more effectively within the new host. We also have a greater competitive ability of the evolved parasite relative to its ancestral, and I believe this is the second error, the ancestral parasite, or the parasite that evolved on the ancestral host. So in other words, within this system, if you injected the animal, for example, with the evolved parasite and the ancestral parasite, you would find that the ancestral parasite would be at a disadvantage. It would be at a competitive disadvantage when you came back to the animal a few days later and isolated parasites from that animal. You'll find that it would be more the evolved parasite than the ancestral. The evolved parasite would have increased in frequency. Again, this is an indication that natural selection is driving all of this. In terms of transmissibility, by contrast, you may get increases, you may get decreases. It really depends on how you've designed the transfer protocol. If the transfer is such that you have a normal means by which the parasite is transmitted, then you may get an increase in the effectiveness of that transmission. Alternatively, if you're bypassing the normal means of transmission, then you likely will end up with a reduced potential to be transmitted by the normal means. In the former host, the expectation is a reduction in the virulence, so less disease, and this is exactly what you're looking for in an attenuated vaccine. You expect less growth. Again, you tend to want that in your attenuated vaccines. You can have a lowered infectivity, meaning that the introduction of the parasite into the new host may have a lower potential for the parasite to, in fact, establish an infection. Alternatively, infectivity could be associated with transmissibility. If you're going through the normal route of transmission of the parasite in the course of your serial passage experiments, that normal route may be reduced in its effectiveness for the parasite, particularly if you're bypassing that normal route during your passages themselves. So you're not basically maintaining the normal route of transmission in the course of your selective scheme. And then in terms of clearance from the new host, the parasite actually can become worse at resisting the effects of the old host's immune system in the course of adapting to the new host, and potentially becoming less easily cleared from the new host. So the impacts on the new host tend to be negative, whereas the impacts on the old host tend to be reduced if you were to introduce the evolved strain back to the old host. And again, the transmissibility, whether you get an increase or decrease, really depends on how the transmission was effected between the hosts in the course of the serial passage experiment. So a lot of these ideas of getting better on the new host and getting worse on the old host can be described as antagonistic pleiotropies. So the contrast between effects on the different hosts can be due to antagonistic pleiotropies. We get trade-offs between within-host growth rates as well as the potential for transmission. This idea that if you bypass transmission, the normal mechanism of transmission, you can end up with less effective transmission evolving, and that also can be a antagonistic pleiotropy, particularly if the evolution of better within-host growth corresponds on a permutation basis to a reduction in effectiveness of transmission. That is, if you can get a single gene that gives rise to a combination of increased within-host growth rates and decreased between-host transmission. Often these parasites have to go through substantial changes in how they do things in order to be transmitted. They might have to take on a different form. They may have to move to a new location in the host. And these things are costly in terms of the ability of these parasites to actually replicate within these hosts, because it might be moving to a place where replication doesn't occur, or sampling a portion of the population that therefore will be devoted to transmission rather than devoted to replication. So if you have a selection scheme that basically bypasses the normal means of transmission, it's not so much that you will have necessarily direct selection against the ability to be transmitted, but there might be benefits to taking on adaptations that have a cost associated in terms of transmission. And when you're evolving these benefits, when selection is favoring these, for example, within-host growth rate benefits, at the same time, they may be selected against the ability of the parasite to be transmitted. And this is an antagonistic pleiotropy. It's a pleiotropy if it's controlled by a single gene. If a single gene can control both growth rates and transmission ability, if you could in that would be a pleiotropy. If you could increase growth rates at the expense of transmission ability, that would be an antagonistic pleiotropy. It would be beneficial in one circumstance and detrimental in another. So production rates of different parasite life stages can trade off with each other so that an increase in the production in one stage can lead to a decrease in production in another stage. Again, this is an antagonistic pleiotropy. So one life stage is this ability to grow within hosts, and another life stage is this ability to be transmitted between hosts. And you can have mutations that increase your ability to grow within a host that come at the expense of your ability to be transmitted between hosts. Again, these are different life stages. Similarly, if a mutation in a single gene results in greater parasite numbers within a host, and that increase is positively correlated with parasite potential for a transmission, then that too is a pleiotropy, because it's affecting two different things, growth in host and ability to be transmitted. But when you have the increase in within-host growth corresponding to an increase in ability to transmit, that's not an antagonistic pleiotropy, because selection isn't going in two different directions. Instead, selection is going in the same direction. And so again, it's a pleiotropy. It's affecting two different aspects of phenotype, but it's not an antagonistic pleiotropy. An antagonistic pleiotropy is where you get improvements in one manner, in one phenotype that's affected, but decreases in the effectiveness of another another aspect of a phenotype that's affected. So, for example, when you have improvement in growth on one host and that corresponds to a decrease in ability to grow on another host, that's an antagonistic pleiotropy, because you have a phenotype, two different phenotypes, ability to grow on one host versus ability to grow on another host, and these two different phenotypes are being affected in different ways. In one way, in one host, you have an increase in ability, in another host, you have a decrease in ability. That's an antagonistic pleiotropy. More than one phenotype affected, but with an antagonistic pleiotropy, they're affected essentially in opposite directions, especially as with regard to functionality or fitness. So correlations, these correlations between within-host growth Also, for example, within host virulence represent a pleiotropy as well. This too is not an antagonistic pleiotropy. It's an increase in the potential to do two different things, the two different phenotypes, and it's an increase in this case in the ability to do these two different things. So this again is a pleiotropy, but it's not an antagonistic pleiotropy. You're improving two different aspects of the phenotypic impact of a given gene. And this whole idea of antagonistic pleiotropy, as we've noted, is a concept that comes from senescence, that is aging research, where improvements during one life stage, such as early in life, can come at the expense of functionality or fitness in another life stage, such as later in life. So this idea of improvements in one life stage, such as within host growth ability, coming at the expense of the ability to be effective at another life stage, such as during transmission, is very conceptually similar to the idea of senescence. In a sense, these guys are front-loading their fitness, but it's at the expense of their long-term fitness. So this is a representation of, in fact, antagonistic pleiotropy. So you've got a parasite and you're passaging it either on host number one or host number two, or instead you're alternating between the two hosts. When you have passage just on host number one, and I should note that it'd be nice if somehow they had the colors corresponding here, but host number one passage corresponds to host number one to the blue bars. And so what you're seeing is a fitness increase on host number one, but you are seeing a decline in the fitness on host number two. So host number A is host number one, is blue is black, and host B is host number two, is red, I guess it's red. Imagine that. Anyway, this is a wonderful example of how not to label your figure. But regardless, on host number two, when you just passage on host number two, what you have is a decrease in the ability to replicate on the first host, but an increase in the ability to replicate on the second host. So these are antagonistic pleiotropies. This is a phenotype. This is a phenotype. The ability to replicate on the two different hosts. You're seeing an increase in one phenotype and essentially a decrease in the other phenotype. You know it's a decrease because on the other host, you're seeing an increase in the relative ability to infect and replicate on that host, and a decrease in the ability on host number one. So this contrast between the increase versus the decrease in this functionality as an antagonistic pleiotropy. Alternatively, on the host where you have alternation, you end up with a generalist. The generalist in this case is able to infect both the hosts fairly well, although generalists often are not as good at infecting specific hosts as the specialists are on those hosts, or a generalist is not as effective at exploiting a specific environment as the specialist for that environment tends to be. This is why there tends to be evolution of specialists, but also the generalists, because they have more environments that they're capable of effectively exploiting, are more resistant to extinctions, and then that's why the world has still retains lots of generalists. There's always a tendency for organisms to specialize unless they have some reason or no choice but to alternate between different environments, in which case they'll tend not to specialize. So one of the things that takes place in the course of serial passage experiments is adaptation of the organisms. And we've talked about this already in terms of the increase in the fitness of the organisms. But the organisms adapt to their environment in ways that go beyond fitness. And in fact, to a degree, we can channel these adaptations to evolve useful properties in the organisms that we're subjecting to the serial passage. So modification of microorganisms via serial passage has occurred for almost as long as pure culture technique has existed. You take these cultures, you isolate just a single individual. This is what microbiologists do, and then you passage the individual organisms. Now, usually your goal is to not evolve the organisms, but if you want, particularly if you're passaging organisms in large numbers per passage, you can have the population evolve towards improving their ability to replicate in whatever environment you're actually doing the passages within. So, indeed, in propagating pure cultures of microorganisms, one must actually be careful to guard against the cultures adapting to the culture conditions. So, especially in modern microbiology, which has been going on for 50 or more years now, maybe 60 or 70 or more years now, let's go back to the 1940s or so. We're talking about where we, in fact, want our microorganisms to remain stable within the laboratory so that they're not a moving target as we characterize them. And to do that, particularly if you have to keep passaging the experiment, sorry, if you have to keep passaging the cultures, you attempt to minimize the ability of those cultures to evolve, and we do this typically by not propagating the cultures en masse, but instead by isolating the cultures down to a single organism, like a single bacterium or a single virus, on a fairly regular basis. And this will have the effect of ideally having you propagate predominantly what is the wild type genotypes of the culture or genotype of the culture rather than having other alleles successfully compete against the wild type and therefore taking over your culture. And this is done by periodic bottlenecking. Now, ideally, you're doing this in such a way that the culture is not accumulating mutations to the point when you do this bottlenecking, you actually end up fixing mutations. And that can occur if you have a culture that displays too high a mutation rate, such as within an RNA virus population. But if you're trying to evolve these cultures, what you do is you do the exact opposite of what you would do for pure culture technique. You would instead propagate the culture by passaging very large numbers of individuals. Therefore, you're not inadvertently losing relatively rare mutations within the population, such as beneficial mutations. Those mutations, therefore, deterministically by natural selection, will have the potential to increase in their frequency within the population, and thus the population will become better adapted to the environment it's in, such as using novel carbon sources, if indeed that's the kind of thing you're attempting to evolve, or increasing its potential to use carbon sources that otherwise doesn't have a great potential to use, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a passage that I pulled out of a 1922 book. It's actually an English translation of a 1921 book. Where they're talking about basically serial passage experiments in order to modify the properties of organisms. Well, not, maybe not serial passage experiments, but serial passage technique. So these same phage strains were able to acquire by successive passages a very high activity, a potency which enabled them to bring about lysis of very heavy bacterial suspensions. This method of serial passages of the bacteriophage, in which it is forced to develop in vitro at the expense of a given bacterium, corresponds exactly with the method of Pasteur for effecting an enhancement in virulence of a bacterial race by repeated passage through a given animal species. So this stuff has been going on, the serial passage experiments or serial passage technique has been going on for an awfully long time, almost as long as microbiology has been a formal discipline that's involved the propagating of microorganisms. So this is a graph that is showing the results of a serial passage experiment. And so what we have here is Salmonella typhimurium. It's being passaged through mice. Salmonella typhimurium causes a mouse typhoid. And what we have here is the percentage of mice that you infect that end up dying, and so that's a measure of virulence. It's a measure of the negative impact of the parasite on or pathogen on the animal that it's infecting, and you're passaging this strain within mice. And as you increase the number of passages, you are increasing the ability of this bacterium to kill mice. So you're seeing this increase in virulence. And here we're seeing a virus. This is the percentage of prostrate or dead cynomolgus, however one pronounces that, monkeys. So these are your instead of using mice, they're using monkeys here. And instead of passaging the virus in a monkey, they are passaging the virus in vitro in cell culture. And this has the effect of adapting the virus to cell culture. And in the course of doing this, what they're doing is they're attenuating the virus so far as its infection and a virulence in these monkeys. And so what you're seeing here is a decline in the virulence in these monkeys in the course of the serial passage of the virus in a different environment, in this case, cell culture. And passaging viruses in cell culture is a legitimate way to give rise to an attenuated form of the virus that potentially may be used in or as a live attenuated vaccine. And this is poliomyelitis virus, so this is the virus that causes polio. So microbial evolution experiments generally, there are advantages to doing these kinds of experiments, and these advantages are listed by Elena and Lenski, 2003. So microorganisms have been used in evolution experiments, include many bacteria and viruses, as well as algae and fungi, etc. These organisms are well suited to such experiments, and this is why. First of all, microorganisms tend to be relatively easy to work with. They tend to be inexpensive to work with. You can work with large populations. They reproduce quickly, and that allows you to run experiments for many generations, thousands of generations, instead of just maybe 10 generations. They allow large populations to be propagated in small spaces, and this allows you to do, in fact, multiple experiments simultaneously. So you can have a dozen experiments going on all at the same time, and all you have is essentially a dozen flasks that are containing these cultures. Easy to do in a shaking incubator or an incubator shaker. They can be stored in suspended animation. And later revived, which allows for direct comparison with of ancestral with evolved types. One colleague of mine describes these as a fossil record. You basically are freezing down the cultures as you go, and then you can go back to the freezer and look at what kinds of organisms are present during past steps, prior steps, passages in the experiment. Many microbes are asexual, and the clonality enhances the precision of the replication, of the experimental replication. In other words, it's simply easier to do experiments when you don't have organisms having to have sex at multiple stages during the experiment. And also, without sex, you are retaining the genotypes of these organisms over the course of selection, rather than having the genotypes being mixed together every generation. Asexuality also maintains linkage between genetic marker and genomic background into which it is placed, which facilitates fitness measurements. So this is referring to these neutral. Selective markers, where basically you can put them into a background of an organism and you don't have any fears that they're going to be switching over into other organisms in the same experiment with which sex is occurring. In other words, there's the stability, this tying together, the stable tying together of whatever it is that you're looking at that's evolving in terms of alleles, genes, and whatever it is that you're using just to keep track of what is more fit in the experiment using these selectively neutral markers. It's easy to manipulate the environmental variables, such as what resources you're using, the temperatures, for example. It's easy to manipulate and keep track of, especially with whole genome sequencing these days, the genetics of founding populations, as well as the populations that have evolved. And there are abundant molecular and genomic data for many species, as well as techniques for precise genetic analysis and manipulation. In other words, microbiology is a fairly mature science and fairly effective at propagating organisms, at manipulating organisms, at characterizing organisms. And when you're doing experimental microbial evolution, you can take advantage of all of these abilities that microbiology has to offer. So we can continue on in talking about microbial evolution experiments. So this is also from Elena and Lenski, 2003. So they asked the question, how reproducible is evolutionary change? So when you're doing these experiments, you expect evolution to happen, but do you expect the same path to be taken every time you do an experiment? And their answer is that convergence does not always occur. What does that mean? Well, one way of looking at this is that parallel evolution doesn't always occur. If you start with the same lineages, you typically will not end up at the same place evolutionarily after you've gone through multiple generations of evolution. And this, particularly, even if you have a constant environment and a constant genetic background to begin with, is because mutations are stochastic. So they enter into the population at different places at different times, and this really has a strong influence on the pace and the direction of evolution. Another way of looking at this is that if you had infinite populations, you would have every single mutation occurring within the population, and therefore you would actually expect the same deterministic evolutionary pathway. But when you have populations that are smaller than infinite, even if they're very large, even if they consist of millions and billions of individuals, the pace at which you acquire these mutations is going to differ between populations, and that will have a profound effect on the path of evolutionary change. So convergence does not always occur. What is the magnitude of the permutation fitness increase? Well, this turns out to be relevant as well, because this strongly influences, particularly in clonal populations, the path of evolutionary change. So evolutionary adaptation in experimental microbial populations typically occurs through the substitution of relatively few mutations that confer large benefits, as opposed to countless mutations with small benefits. So these countless mutations with small benefits, they will occur at a fairly high rate within these populations, but the big benefit mutations occur at a relatively low rate. And it's the big benefit mutations, particularly as a consequence of a combination of periodic selection and what is known as clonal interference, that end up being fixed within these populations. You'll have smaller benefit mutations actually being fixed as well, but this occurs with less determinism and instead is a consequence more of hitchhiking with these big benefit mutations. How long can we expect the fitness to keep increasing in constant environments? So you've got a microbial evolution experiment, you're passaging it, you're going from generation to generation to generation to generation. Just the fact that you've put it into this environment in the laboratory means that you basically have placed the organisms in a relatively novel environment. They start adapting. There's going to be relatively more big benefit mutations early on than there will be later on. And this is simply because there are more opportunities for adaptation early on when you've entered a novel environment than later on in the environment after, in fact, you've already had a number of these adaptations become fixed in the population. If you think of it as there being a finite number of mutations that these organisms can accrue, then early on the number of mutations that you're going to that are going to be potentially available to you are going to be larger, and you're going to use up these big benefit mutations simply because you're fixing them within the population, and there will be fewer opportunities for big benefit mutations later on. Yet an additional way of thinking about this is that with stabilizing selection, when you've got a population that has been within an environment for a fairly long time, the population has become well adapted to that environment, they're going to be relatively relatively few new mutations that can enter that population that are going to provide the population with a large benefit. And the same thing is true as these populations become adapted to the conditions under which they're undergoing serial passage, as they or continuous culturing. As they become better adapted to their environments, there's going to be relatively fewer opportunities for new mutations to enter the population that in fact will become fixed within the population. So the rate at which the population evolves is going to slow down. The fitness increases are going to be fairly large to begin with and relatively small as time goes on. So in a long-term experiment with 12 E. coli populations, the average fitness gain in the first 5,000 generations was approximately tenfold greater than that between 15,000 and 20,000 generations. But even so, there was some significant improvement over the last interval, which indicated the population still had not reached their maximum fitness. So they're still evolving. They're still increasing in fitness over time. It's just that the rate of increase in fitness is lower. And again, these are all from Elena and Lenski, 2003. So what does this mean that the rate of evolution slows down? So you put a population into an environment and the population starts evolving if that's a novel or even relatively novel environment. You expect to accrue the big benefit mutations early on, which is what's being shown in here. Never mind that there are two curves. It's being shown in this region of these curves. And then as the population becomes better adapted to their environment, the pace of change is going to slow. So the rate of fitness increase, so per unit time, is going to be less than the rate of increase early on in these populations. And this is simply because early on, the population is within a relatively novel environment. There's more opportunities for big benefit mutations, for mutations to be fixed. Later on in the evolution of these populations, they have adapted to these environments better, and there's simply going to be fewer opportunities for large-scale increases in fitness. Now, what's also being shown here is the idea of adaptive landscapes. So in these figures, what you have along this axis and this axis is a measure of genotype and or phenotype. So the organisms have some genotype. It gives rise to some phenotype. The phenotype has some associated fitness, and that associated fitness is graphed on this axis here. So the higher the peak, the higher the fitness. So what they're doing is showing a population that has been initiated right here. It's actually been initiated as two different populations. You split a clonal population, and they are now evolving, adapting to their environments. And what they're doing is they're taking different pathways, and they're taking different pathways because different mutations are entering these populations at different times. This population is taking a pathway that happens to be able to take it up a higher fitness peak than this population is able to. But if you looked at these populations and their increases in fitness from the side of taking a cross section of these graphs, what you would see is a graph that looks like this. The red population is increasing and is increasing in such a way that it is climbing higher up an adaptive peak. And this population too is climbing up, and it too is reaching higher up an adaptive peak. Interestingly, if you actually compare these two graphs, you could imagine that this graph, as well as this graph, is a lot more convex than they're showing them here. It actually looks like they're doing something like this in these figures, rather than something like that. If the two graphs or four graphs were actually more congruent, you would expect there to be a steeper rise at this end and then a broader peak than is actually being shown here. This is just something that the artist who drew these things presumably put into the figures without thinking about it, and the authors didn't notice that there was potentially a discrepancy between these two graphs. On the other hand, if you squint, you can maybe convince yourself that they're going up really steeply right here. In fact, the arrows are longer and then less steeply up here. But it, to my mind, from an artistic perspective, it doesn't seem like that's what's happening. But what you have here are different evolutionary paths. You're ending up in different places phenotypically. You're ending up in different places in terms of the fitness of the populations. And this is represented by that graph versus that graph. And in theory, at least, they're representing in two dimensions these graphs right here. And these graphs are going up these separate adaptive peaks. And again, these are just peaks that are representations of the fitness of the population. And down here is some representation of the genetic diversity and also phenotypic diversity that can be found within these populations. So they're following one particular pathway, exploring genotype in one particular way, accruing mutations. And these guys are exploring genotype or genotype sequence space in a different way, and accruing mutations as they go. So one thing you will see when you're actually following these microbial evolution experiments is that there will be delays in evolution. They may not be obvious, but what that means is that the rate at which the population increases in fitness may be slower than we have an expectation that it might be. And again, Elena and Lenski in their review discuss these issues. And so here's some things to take from that, from their discussion. So one of them is that no matter what, it takes time for a population to fix beneficial mutations. Now, the more beneficial the mutation, the faster the population should fix that mutation. But it's still, I mean, unless you've got a population, a mutation that increases fitness tenfold, say, there's going to be multiple generation delays before you go from the occurrence of a mutation till its fixation. It might be 10 generations, might be 100 generations, might be 1,000 generations. It's going to take time between the arising of a mutation and its actual fixation within a population. Also, you have genetic drift always working against you. Now, when a mutation, even if it's beneficial, if it's not that beneficial, there's some potential for it to be lost by genetic drift. In fact, you can have a beneficial mutation coming into a population that's only slightly better than what mutations are present already, in which case it's almost acting like a neutral mutation. And if it's acting like an, if it's a neutral mutation, then it's basically subject to genetic drift. Its frequency is dependent entirely upon genetic drift. So the extent to which a mutation will increase in frequency deterministically is going to be a function of just how much larger a benefit it provides compared with the other alleles present within the population. And so you've got genetic drift acting against you or slowing things down. And also, when the mutation first arises, it's really rare within the population. There might only be one example of it in the entire population, in which case genetic drift can be quite important. You can have a random loss of that mutation and it's simply gone. So even if you've got these mutations going into the population and the mutations are beneficial to the population, there's still the potential that those mutations are simply going to be lost as a consequence of genetic drift. And they can also be lost due to periodic selection, because in periodic selection, you've got a genotype that displays a sufficiently high fitness that it increases the population, increases that genotype to the point of fixation within the population. But if the population is clonal and it's clonal if periodic selection is operating, then you're only going to fix those alleles that are associated with that genotype at the point where that genotype becomes fixed. And any other beneficial allele within the population, that is, any other allele at any particular locus that happens to be more fit than the alleles that are found in the genotype that's being fixed by periodic selection, these other alleles will be lost. They'll be lost simply because they, by chance, are not found in the genotype that happens to become fixed within the population. So both selection and drift, and selection particularly in clonal populations, can work against the fixation of beneficial mutations or even their substantial increase in frequency within the population. Asexual populations are also subject to clonal interference. That's caused by competition among beneficial mutations that occur in different clones. So once again, you've got a clonal population. They're not mixing together their alleles. You could have one allele that is arising in this population that provides a benefit, and another allele at a different locus that's arising in this population and providing a benefit. But if the two genotypes they're in are the same or approximately the same fitness, then they're simply going to compete against each other. Neither one of them is going to have a sufficient advantage to rise to fixation. And so you're going to have this delay in the fixation of the beneficial alleles. And of course, if one of these then gets a second mutation or a beneficial mutation, or if there's a third lineage within this population that receives a big benefit mutation by chance, then you'll have a rise in that genotype and you'll actually have the loss of all the other beneficial alleles in the population. So clonal interference, which we'll get back to in a sec. It is likely that there are more mutations that confer small advantages than those that provide large benefits. So the supply of small beneficial mutations will not be exhausted as readily as the supply of large benefit mutations. So as we talked about, as the population grows and it evolves, adapts to its environment, you're going to have a slowing down of the rate of adaptive evolution, simply because there are more big benefit mutations down here early on in this part of the curve than there are up here later on in the curve. And that will be seen as, in a sense, a delay in the evolution of the population. If the big benefit mutations are sufficiently rare, and the population has to wait until those benefits arise in order to increase substantially, then you're in fitness, then you're going to have a substantial delay in the evolution, the increase in the average fitness of the population. And we'll look at that as well. So what we have is a population. We've got these two selectively neutral markers that we can keep track of, so we can differentiate the different clones within the population that we started with. And we're seeing this situation where we have a delay in the increase in the fitness of one of the markers relative to the other, and then suddenly one of the markers will increase substantially in fitness. So these are our selectively neutral markers. This delay here, this is the delay until there is a sufficiently beneficial mutation that is entered into either of these two populations to cause a substantial change in the frequency of the selectively neutral markers. And this could be because there are mutations entering in, but you've got clonal interference going on, or alternatively, it simply is taking time until sufficiently beneficial mutations enter into the population that you're going to be seeing any real change in allele frequencies within the population. And then suddenly, bang, you've got in one of these lineages, one of the subpopulations carrying one of the selectively neutral markers, in this case the ERA plus marker, suddenly there's a mutation there, it provides a big benefit, and pow, you've got this population increasing in frequency. But it increases in frequency only so long as that big benefit provides a selective benefit relative to the other alleles that are present within the population. And if you should happen to have a second mutation, this one in the other lineage, the ERA minus lineage, suddenly you can have a slowing down or elimination altogether of the increase in frequency associated with this big benefit mutation that occurred down here, or in fact, probably occurred all the way down here, perhaps. And then you have perhaps a switch where you have another mutation, the ERA minus lineage, where it's giving it another benefit that increases its frequency slightly, its relative frequency. And then you have a reversal where yet another mutation ends up in this ERA plus lineage and you have an increase. And actually, this mutation, it probably occurred somewhere down here or something like that. You have this ongoing increase in the frequency of the particular mutation that is giving you this benefit. But that mutation is starting out with a frequency of one divided by the entire population size. So it's not happening right here. It's happening somewhere back there. And this delay here could be due to clonal interference if indeed you are accruing beneficial mutations, but they're just not sufficiently beneficial to overcome the benefits seen in the other lineage by new mutations. Or alternatively, it's simply taking time for the mutations to enter into these populations, having occurred somewhere down here, until they've increased their frequency sufficiently that they're actually having a significant impact on the ratio of RA plus to RA minus markers within the population. So we've talked a lot about clonal interference, so let's talk more about clonal interference. So often within populations, there are multiple alleles that are found at multiple loci that can confer fitness benefits. So this is going to be true whether your population is clonal or not. It simply means that evolution is happening across multiple loci. In asexual populations, these beneficial mutations may not all be found within the same individual. So you have multiple competing genotypes, they're not exchanging genes, they're going to all be subject to mutation, and the beneficial alleles are going to stochastically arise in whatever genotype they happen to arise in. And it is highly unlikely that two beneficial mutations are going to be found in the same lineage versus found in separate lineage, particularly if the mutations are happening more or less simultaneously. And so the result is that you end up having beneficial alleles that are found in two different lineages. Those alleles have no way of being exchanged such that they end up in the same individual. And as a consequence, the beneficial alleles end up competing with one another. And this results in a failure of either of those alleles to actually increase in frequency until it's fixed within the population. The resulting fitness of different genotypes is similar. If the resulting fitness of different genotypes is similar, then they may be unsuccessful in competing against each other. Unsuccessful in the sense that neither one is going to gain an upper hand. That is, in clonal populations, beneficial alleles may find it difficult to become fixed unless they are found as part of genotypes that aggregately display a substantially greater fitness than other members of the population. So getting back to periodic selection, and clonal interference is a consequence of the same kinds of mechanisms that give rise to periodic selection. It is the genotype, the fitness of the genotype, that determines whether or not the genotype will become fixed, whether or not a given lineage will become fixed. And if you've got different genotypes competing and they are acquiring different mutations, it might be an arms race, but no one genotype necessarily is going to win out. And this is the problem with these small benefit mutations. This is the reason why in these clonal populations, they don't tend to contribute, at least during the microbial evolution experiments, they don't tend to contribute greatly to an increase in the average fitness of the population. And that's because what these genotypes are waiting for are these big benefit mutations, which suddenly do provide a sufficiently high fitness benefit that the genotype that carries those big benefit mutations will increase until they're fixed within the population. Now, remember we talked very early on about how the adaptation tends to build, how you have one beneficial mutation building upon another beneficial mutation, building upon another, so that genotypes increase the number of beneficial mutations that they carry. In other words, they're adapting to their environment. Well, in the case of these big benefit mutations, what happens is you'll have one genotype rising to the point of fixation, and then every single individual within that population will carry this big benefit mutation. You'll have a bunch of small benefit mutations, you'll have clonal interference, nothing really happens until you have another mutation that's sufficiently large that it too sweeps through the population to the point of fixation. Chances are that that next big benefit mutation is happening in a genetic background that the previous big benefit mutation is present in, because that big benefit mutation rose to fixation. So it's essentially in everybody within the population. And so you have a building up of these big benefit mutations over time. The problem is that the potential for big benefit mutations slows down over time. So the population, in terms of its average fitness, tends to slow, in terms of the increases in its average fitness, tends to slow over time. Let's see if I'm doing this in a way where you could actually see that. But nevertheless, what's happening is that you're getting a big benefit mutation. It's going to fixation. Then the population has that big benefit mutation in it, and you have the next big benefit mutation coming along, increasing the population a little bit more, carrying along the original big benefit mutation. Another big benefit mutation comes along, and so on and so forth. It may be that big mutations come along faster early on, and that's why you get your bigger rise, rather than that the mutations are bigger early on overall in terms of their fitness impact, and that you're getting fewer mutations later on that provide this big benefit that allows the population to get past clonal interference and thereby find its way to fixation and thereby represent part of the genotype that the next big benefit is going to be found in, big benefit mutation is going to be found in. This asexuality and natural selection associated barrier to allele fixation is known as clonal interference. The fact that you can't, that two genotypes might both, may very well have one or more beneficial mutations in them, but their overall fitness is not that different relative to each other that one of them can rise up to the point of fixation and thereby serve as the genotype that it, the next round of selection and acquisition of big benefit mutations will be found as a part of. It is a consequence in the sense of otherwise fitness-enhancing alleles being associated with selectively neutral genotypes, in part because of the focus alleles simply do not supply sufficient benefits to the bearer. So this clonal interference, it's a result of basically all of the genotypes either being identical within the population or otherwise having acquired these neutral mutations so that they themselves have no selective advantage relative to each other. And then within this context of these multiple, more or less the same fitness genotypes, you have various small benefit mutations arising that simply increase the benefit of some genotypes relative to others within the population. But if there are enough of these small benefit mutations around, then no single genotype is going to have a sufficient benefit associated with it that it will rise to the point of fixation. It's only when you happen to acquire enough of these small benefit mutations or alternatively one sufficiently big mutation that you'll have one genotype that overcomes this global interference, gets beyond it, rises to the fixation in the course of periodic selection, and you end up with the fixation of that genotype along with all of the alleles associated with it within the population. And then once again, it's that fixed genotype that now serves as the basis of all the genotypes within the population. That's now the neutral background within the population, and that's now the genotype background in which these beneficial, small beneficial or large beneficial mutations are going to arise. So we've got time. Once again, we've got these selectively neutral markers. Again, it's this ARA plus and ARA minus. We've got these populations where either the ARA minus is getting the upper hand or the ARA plus is getting the upper hand. And what we have, what we're seeing in here, are delays before the initiation of, in fact, any kinds of substantial changes in the frequencies of these two selectively neutral alleles. And you're seeing the same kind of thing over here. So the delays may be due to clonal interference. I mean, these delays are going on for some time. We're out here 20 days or so, and we don't have really significant change in the population. So it may be that, in fact, there are these little beneficial mutations that are arising, but none of them are sufficiently great that they're allowing either one of these selectively neutral markers to get the upper hand. Although at the same time, keep in mind that the occurrence of a beneficial mutation doesn't mean that it's going to be obvious within the population immediately. It's going to take time for that mutation to increase from a copy of just one to the point where it's taking up a significant fraction of the population, and therefore any fitness benefit associated with it will be seen in terms of changes in the frequencies, particularly of the selectively neutral markers that they're associated with. So potentially clonal interference is going on in here. And then what you're seeing here is some kind of big benefit mutation. Some kind of big benefit mutation has shown up in one of these lineages. In this case, it would be the R minus, since they're going down, since the graph is pointing downward. And what that is showing you is that, in fact, you're not up to this point. You don't have a significant frequency of a sufficiently beneficial mutation for the population frequencies of these neutral markers to change substantially. The population is not changing substantially in average fitness. And certainly these two are not changing in terms of their relative fitness to any great extent until by chance one of the genotypes ends up with a sufficiently beneficial mutation that the population is suddenly veers off towards a substantial increase in the frequency of the selectively neutral marker that happens to be in the same genotype as the big benefit mutation. And then here we have a particularly big beneficial mutation. So this is the population, this is the Lenski E. coli population. And you can see by 2008, they're publishing having had the population go out 30,000 generations. So this has been going on in 2008 for approximately 20 years. They were basically passaging E. coli on a day-to-day basis. And now the population is going along. And in terms of the population size, suddenly a little past the 33rd thousandth generation, the population is increasing substantially. So what's going on? So these populations are going through the standard bacterial growth curve. So they're going through a lag phase, and then they're going through a log phase, and then they're going through a stationary phase. It's at the stationary phase that they're doing these measurements. They're inoculating the tubes in the morning, fresh broth, and the cultures are growing up till stationary phase. And at stationary phase, they're keeping track of the optical density. That's the turbidity. That's a measure of how many bacteria are present within these populations. And you can see the optical density wasn't getting very high. And it wasn't getting very high because the amount of carbon that's in these cultures that these the E. coli can use as their energy and carbon source, it really isn't that substantial. Except that within the media, there's also this citrate. And the citrate isn't used by E. coli. E. coli is just going along using its glucose, no big deal. But at this generation, the population of E. coli suddenly figured out how to use the citrate. And as a consequence of that, at stationary phase, the number of cells and therefore the optical density of the culture is substantially higher. It looks like it's sixfold or more higher than it had been down here. So this was an opportunity that had been sitting there for over 30,000 generations for this E. coli population, and they couldn't take advantage of it. And presumably the reason why they couldn't take advantage of it is because the mutation rate to that particular adaptation was very, very low. And in fact, it seems to have required more than one mutation in order to get to this point. So it was a very unlikely adaptation to enter into the population. And they had 12 replicate lineages, and it only entered into one of these lineages. So what we got is a substantial big benefit mutation. It took an awful long time, 20 years of propagating this culture, until finally we saw this big benefit mutation. And when we saw it, it kind of took over the population. Actually, it's more complicated than that. It didn't actually take over the population, in part because there were costs, there were trade-offs associated with being able to use citrate. But at any rate, that is a big benefit mutation. We had adaptation going on all through this time. In fact, going back to... Yeah, there we are, here, all through this time. And we're out here somewhere at this point in time. And then suddenly, boom, the population increases substantially in its fitness as a consequence of acquiring this ability to utilize the citrate, the carbon source, carbon energy source that was always in these cultures. It's just that E. coli couldn't utilize the citrate. So there's an increase in population size at the point of acquisition of ability to utilize exogenous citrate, the citrate that's found outside the cell. The E. coli could always use citrate. I mean, citrate is something that's associated with the Krebs citric acid cycle. So it's not as though E. coli can't utilize citrate. It just can't get it into its cell. And so it had to figure out how to get citrate into the cell. So it had to come up with some novel mutation that allowed it to start transporting citrate from outside of the cell, where it was found in abundance, to inside of the cell. And once it was inside of the cell, it could use that citrate as a carbon and energy source.